Welcome to the Up the Cream podcast, episode 21. I'm Dan Thomas, and I'm joined as always by Rich Harrison, aka Pommy. Rich, how are you doing, pal?
I'm well, mate. And you?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. Despite a Hull FC loss, it feels a while ago now. I mean, you wait 3 weeks to see a game. You go on the Thursday night, you record this on a Monday morning. Yeah, I'm trying to remember what happened, but it wasn't great, was it? All getting beat 40-26. Yeah, not great.
No, and it was a bit of a glimpse of the old Hull, wasn't it? Not a great performance, not defensively a great performance. We looked a bit soft, a bit spongy around the middle. Very untypical for a Brett Hodgson-coached Hull side.
It was, and that's where the critics were defensively, because, you know, we haven't been used to that under Brett Hodgson. Defence is the first thing he's sorted out, and it's that defensive drum that we've banged all year. And it just wasn't there at Huddersfield, unfortunately. They went through us at ease, they busted the line, they went around us and scored in the corners as well. It's just, you know, to leak eight tries, it was disappointing. There was circumstances obviously affected it, you know, and obviously not playing in 3 weeks against a side that has played 3 weeks since we last played them at the KCOM. Obviously, you can see the COVID factor at all as well. You know, obviously, players coming back from COVID, you know, not really training over the past 3 weeks, and then obviously the 11 players that are out. But the excuses only go so far, don't they? They are relevant, but they're not 40 points and eight tries worth of excuses, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between a reason and an excuse, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
An excuse is something you can hide behind, and we shouldn't be hiding behind that. We should have done better. You know, Huddersfield are a team we should be beating. Simple as. You had players playing out of position, but we've had players playing out of position, you know, all season, really. Swift is a more than able deputy at fullback. But, you know, do we lose? You know, it's a big difference between running on the wing and running in the fullback role. You know, you've got to do a lot of covering and a lot of backing up around the play of the ball and everything, and you've got to need a big motor for that. And I thought he tired quite a lot, and he was out of position for a couple of their tries, and he could have probably done a little bit better. I thought Cam Scott was average. You know, just you can't really point to any of them and say, yeah, you had a decent game. Probably apart from Vuli Kijipali, who ran hard and tackled hard.
Yeah, I'd probably argue I'd put Savilia in that as well. I thought he ran hard all game. Yeah. And obviously a couple of brownie points for landing a few blows on Josh Jones at the end of the game. I'm sure we'll come on to that later. But yeah, it was just a poor day at the office, wasn't it? It was just, that's a massive cliche, obviously, to yours. But that's what it was. It was just a poor performance. And it's all right, it's like you say, saying all these excuses and all these reasons why he got beat, but you can guarantee Brett Hodgson would have been fuming about that, because like we say, the first thing he said when he came through the door was about raising standards as a whole club. And those standards we saw on Thursday night were up to the bar that we set this year, as I said, and you can guarantee he wouldn't have been happy with that. And I sort of understood it. You know, we know the score with Hull this year, we know that we're very quality over quantity, and that when we had a few out, we would struggle, and that's why... Yeah. You know, that expression you use, which I actually love, the ragtag Hull FC makeshift side that beat Huddersfield 3 weeks ago. That's why we raved so much about it, because it was, you know, 13 players out, backs to the wall, 10-0 down at half time. And to turn it around, it was nothing short of phenomenal. And obviously, they couldn't do that, you know, two games in a row. And it sort of shows where we're at. We know the score, don't we? We know that our first 17 will be a match for anyone in that competition. But when we make changes and when others come in, that's where we struggle. And it's understandable. Like you say, we know where we're at, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And you know, when you've got players playing out of position, when you're picking a side, knowing full well that it's unlikely that you're going to use all 17 players, because, I mean, Burrell didn't even get on, did he? You know, I mean, that we're down to the absolute bare bones, you know, pulling people in from that played for the club two seasons ago that are now playing semi-professional football in the second division, you know. It's down to the bare bones. But again... You know, we've been down to the bare bones before and we've produced. It's just a shame we didn't this time.
No, exactly.
I will say, though, on the Savelio front, you know, brilliant to see him landing a couple on Josh Jones, but he's going to get a 2 or 3-match ban now. And that just compounds our problem.
Yeah.
We were already light in the forwards.
Yeah, I get you. And it's funny when we start talking about bans, because usually the disciplinary stuff comes out after we finish recording. Usually as you go to sleep in Australia and... You'll wake up the next day and you'll see it, and I'll probably go to training later at Cot Tigers, and you know, you see the news come out and you're thinking, oh, God's sake. And I think we're just going to have to cop it. whatever comes out, if Ligi Sal gets one, I'll be really disappointed because that should be sin bin sufficient. I mean, the sin bin itself was dubious.
I agree.
If he gets one, I'll be filming with that. But yeah, I think Sevilla, I mean, can you say it was sending off sufficient? Probably not. Bear in mind it was after full time, so the send off.
And they were still going at it when they went off as well.
Yeah, the fact they went back for more as well. But you know, I think every case is different, innit? And you've got to look at the history between them two blocks, and you've got to look at, you know, obviously the emotions that we're riding obviously at the moment. And you know, Josh Jones is no secret at Leicester. He took the absolute piss out of the club last year. You can guarantee some verbals would have been exchanged between them, and obviously that obviously ended up with Sevilla smacking him in the face a couple of times. So yeah, I say well done, Andrea Sevilla. Yeah, he didn't miss. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. A couple of brownie points for him there, and well done, pal.
Yeah, and you know, it's a very underrated punch, is the uppercut. And he got a couple of good ones in there. It was brilliant.
I was buzzing to see that. It was good to see the old crowd as well, give Jones love.
Can I just remind you, Dan, a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the Biff, and I said to you, I do miss it, and you said, no, we've moved on as a sport, and I'm like, no, there's got to be a place for a bit of a punch-up. You're like, no, you know, kids don't want to play, you know, parents don't want kids to play if there's a punch-up.
Depends who it is.
Just to hear the glee in your voice, because it was Josh Jones that got punched, you bloody hypocrite.
Yeah, I'll cut that one. Yeah, I'll take that, but I'm quite happy to see Josh Jones get smacked in the face a couple of times. Absolutely, probably the same with a couple of other players as well, who shall remain nameless until it happens, but yeah. I was very, very content and pretty smug, and it was a little win, and the crowd did respond to it at Huddersfield, and you know, we knew we were well beat, but yeah, it was just little wins like that, wasn't it? Crowd shouting Andrea Sevilla's name, and obviously calling Jones a couple of fat, you know, superlatives on the end of that as well. So yeah, it was interesting, but yeah, as I say, not a good night. Very, very poor from what we've seen of all this year. And as like you say, with the Aidan Burrell thing, it's the third time that's happened this year now. Obviously, Cam Scott was unused against Warrington. Marcus Walker was an unused interchange against Huddersfield at home. And then obviously Huddersfield away Thursday night, Aidan Burrell is one. So that's three times this year where we've run with 16 players. And I get it. It is tough to bring a player on when you're already getting mullered and he's played, 2 minutes in his first grade career. But at the same time, then you're thinking, why name him on the bench? I mean, Jack Logan is one.
I think he's capable of it. Don't name him.
Yeah, Jack Logan was obviously in the 19 that we named, and so was Jude Ferreira. Jude Ferreira's the same box. Obviously, he's yet to make his first grade debut. But
yeah,
I know Hodgson likes to carry her back on the bench as well. I'm just thinking, as Logan maybe pulled up, has something gone on in the background that we all don't know about? You know, who knows? But it just seemed a bit surprising because, like I say, Hodgson, he does like an outside back on the bench, and Logan was right there waiting. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, they were talking about extending Logan's loan contract as well, weren't they?
They were, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It must be frustrating for Jack as well because, you know, Batley have played back-to-back weekends. I saw Kieran Buchanan put a post out on his Instagram. He actually scored for Batley at the weekend, so it was good to see. Obviously, an ex-Hull lad doing well. Which is, it's a weird one, isn't it? But say what we went with, the 16 players that played at Huddersfield, it just wasn't good enough, was it? Like you say, Swift up fullback, it was, you know, makeshift. Villager Capani was decent, but Frua was quiet. Carlos started well, but faded out. And obviously, when he went to fullback, it's not really natural when he's been playing at centre for 4 years. And I thought Sneed had a dig, but, you know, he's a first receiver. He needs someone coming out the back. And obviously, young Ben McNamara tried. There was no natural fullback there. It was just tough for them all, just beaten by a better side on the day. And I suppose you can say that happens. I mean, totally. Look at Huddersfield. I mean, Oliver Russell, for them, I thought he ran the show. Ex-Wigan half-back, Wigan Junior. He was brilliant. Yeah. And Will Price on his fourth game. I mean, Christ. I know you used to say, watching Steve Norton, Lee Crooks, and then Ben coming through, that makes you feel old. Well, how does that make me feel now, watching Leon Price's son playing Soap League? I'm like, crikey.
He must, you know what, though? With the amount of clubs that Leon Price played for at the back end of his career, you know, because he was, you know, obviously he was known for being, well, it was Bradford, then Saints, wasn't he? And then obviously known for being Catalans and us as well. His son must have been, what, I mean, was he with him at the time? Was he going through the ranks of all of those teams? You know, did he kind of bring him along to training and stuff? Or has he always been in the Huddersfield system?
I reckon he's always been in the Huddersfield system, yeah. When you think about it, when you think, what is Will Price now? He's 18 years old, tops.
Yeah.
You think when he came to all that's 5 years ago, so it would have been 12, 13. Yeah. He would have been playing in the community game, wouldn't he?
Yeah. What a missed opportunity for every club. Because he looks electric, doesn't he?
He does look good, yeah. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's going to get comparisons to his dad all the way through his career now. That's going to be natural because, obviously, Leon's a bloody rugby league legend on this side of the world, and rightly so, because he had a phenomenal career. But he's his own man in his own right, isn't he? And yeah, you're right, there will be some clubs sniffing and watching his progress. But yeah, I just thought Huddersfield went well. We were poor. It's as simple as that. And you know, Nathan Peat's at Hooker really impressed me. Obviously, the signing from Lee a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
It was a weird one, that.
Good player.
Yeah, great. Good player. Origin a few years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, and really suffered over here. I mean, he was kind of shuffled out of Parramatta due to salary cap when they. It was really when they tried to re-sign Jared Hayne after his little spell in the NFL, and to try and get him, they kind of shifted a load of players sideways, and then Hayne ended up going back. He ended up signing for the Gold Coast Titans instead, and. And that's where Pete's ended up. Pete's ended up at the Gold Coast as well. So yeah, it was a bit weird. He kind of went kind of mid season, and he's a good hooker. He's a really good scheming hooker. Very quick out of acting half. Really good pass selection from dummy half. You know, he can pick a man out. He's a really good rake. But you know, one of those things. He should probably never have gone to Lee in the first place. But he's in a better team now, and you'll see him start to play better, I think.
Yeah, I was impressed, and like I say, there are a couple of big forwards as well, like Nathan L. Pettirew, and you know, it's just like some of the young ones as well. Oliver Wilson was good as well.
You
know, even the young kid they brought off the bench, Ronson Stevens, he had a crack in the last few minutes, and obviously I know Ian Watson had a whinge because Savelio gave him a little bit of a big shot, thinking, well, what do you expect? It's like, for God's sake, this is rugby league. If you're not prepared for young lads to get hit, exactly. It's like, oh, he's 18 years old, should we put some like ribbons on his thighs and play, touch rugby?
You're not allowed to tackle him. Jesus Christ, it always used to be a bloody rite of passage, you know, welcome to the big time, son. Bang. Yeah. I remember one of Kirk Yeaman's first ever games. He got absolutely creamed. I think it was against St. Helens. He had a terrible game. He was dropping ball. They were hitting him with everything they had, do you know? And it's a mark of the player how he comes back from that. And what game two's like, and what game three's like. If you're wrapping him in cotton wool so much that you think you can't take a hard hit, well, then he's never going to make it, is he?
Well, exactly. If you're going to wrap him in cotton wool, like you say, then why is he there in the first place? Cause,
yeah.
And then you look back to, again, that name, Lee Crooks, as an 18-year-old at the top of the Rugby League world, mixing it with, you know, seasoned Aussie Test veterans like Les Boyd at the time. Different game back then, of course, but it's like, come on. We've had teenage superstars in the past just because they're 18 years old. Tell me you can't hit them. God. Ian Watson, though, I mean.
Jeez.
He's an absolute muppet, isn't he?
Oh, he is. He really is. We've had a bloody close count there. We really have. Yeah. We're lucky we didn't get him. He just, you know, he just, I don't know, he just seems to be full of his own self-importance. I don't get what the thing is with him, you know, because, he's... He got Salford to Wembley and he got him to a grand final, didn't he?
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's not won anything. I mean, it was two losses. But he just, I don't know whether he believes his own press or what, but he's not all that, is he?
No, it winds me up to be honest, because you look at the way he conducts himself and what he says, and you sort of look at Brett Hodgson. I know I just said earlier that, you know, secretly he would have been fuming with what happened on Thursday. He would have said it's not good enough and not what, you know, the standards that he wants all to live up to.
Yeah.
But in the media, he's all class. He says the right things, you know, he praised Huddersfield, you know, said where we went wrong and where we need to do better, and he's just so calm and composed, and literally, you can't buy class, you either got it or not, and like you say, he's been a breath of fresh air, whether we win, lose or draw this year with Brett Hodgson. It's just, you know, things like that, and we talked about, as I say, our quality over quantity approach that we've definitely seen it all this year. I mean, we've thrown a lot of eggs into the basket with Josh Reynolds, who was unfortunately out with COVID at the moment, and you could probably argue we're throwing a lot of eggs into our basket with Jake Connor too, once he got his bumper deal after he made his England debut. So it is what it is. We know the score, but when them two are playing, we know that we're going to be a very dangerous outfit this year. And I'm sort of thinking with Hodgson, as he implements, you know, the standards, all the philosophies and different ways of playing that he wants to implement into the club, Once everyone gets to song with that and gets to grips with it and goes into the second year and the third year with Hodgson, then we're going to be a much better side than we are right now, isn't it? I sort of look at it, it's his first season. Imagine what he's going to do in his second year at Hull and his third year at Hull. I think it is a really exciting prospect. And like I say, I know it's a disappointing defeat on Thursday, but it's the first time this year we can really say that. I just think, you know, just got to accept it for what it is and strive to get better. And I think we will do that under Hodgson. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've said before, the acid test for me is when he starts wheeling and dealing with transfers and stuff and getting players in and out. That the acid test for me is very much on his recruitment and retention and who he allows to leave. And obviously in the current climate with COVID and with, you know, us not playing every game and games getting postponed and, you know, who knows where the sport's going to be this time next year and who knows what players think about moving to clubs and moving away from home and all the rest of it with lockdowns and all this kind of stuff and possible COVID tests and who knows. It's unusual times, but you'd like to think that we keep the best of the players that we've got right now. We cut some of the fat and we bring in some genuine class. And we maybe bring in a couple of roughies from somewhere else just to make up the numbers, you know, to make sure that when we've got a situation like this, well, you know, we're not running with two props because we haven't got anybody else. Or we're not running with second rowers having to play in the front row or, you know, wingers having to play at fullback because we have a little bit more strength in depth. He's inherited a very unbalanced side, and it looks like he's trying to put that right a little bit. Obviously, with Barita, Farima going, and hopefully another forward or two coming in, he's going to redress that balance a little bit because we were very kind of wing heavy at one point and backs heavy, and we need some grunt up front.
Yeah.
Not to say that, you know, watching Andre Sevelio putting a couple on Josh Jones doesn't mean we've got a bit of grunt up front, but we need more than him doing it, you know.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Like you say, we've got Chris Satai, we've got Liggy Sau, we've got Andre Sevelio, we've got Manu Mao, you know, we've got Scott Taylor when he's fit. Brad Fashel's done very well this year, I'll give him that, but Josh Bowden still left a little bit to be desired for me. I feel for him, I really do, because his whole career, I remember before the two cup winning years, it was the same thing. He'd get a foot injury, he'd get a shoulder injury, a back injury, whatever, and he'd be out, he'd come back, he'll play five or six games, then he'd be out again. Those two cup winning years, I think he played 30 games both season, bang, bang, does his ACL the following year. Now it's the same problem. He comes back in the side, can't stay fit, gets injured again. And you just got to pray that this time now, say coming back for the first time in 6 weeks, you just got to pray that this is the sequence of games that he can get under his belt and kick on and get some form and fitness back into his game. Because, you know, he's 29 years old now, so he's, if you like, he's at the peak years as a prop forward. And if we can get the Bowden that we got in those two cup winning years, who was so underrated in that side coming off the bench with Chris Green, then, you know, we've got a player there, haven't we? We know that, but it's just keeping him fit, that's the problem. But you're right, we all know that we need reinforcements in the forwards.
He's been so unlucky though.
He has, yeah.
He's just, you poor bugger. You know, I mean, he hyperextending his elbow, which was a horrendously painful thing to happen, you know, and then doing his ACL and, you know, and just, he's been so unlucky. You really feel for him. I mean, we've had players like that before. You know, I remember Steve Craven used to be a bit like that. You know, you just think if you got a bloody good run in the first team, you'd be absolutely devastating, but he just, you know, just always picked up a niggly injury or, you know, had half a season out or whatever. There's been, you know, players after players after players that have done that, unfortunately. And I just hope he's not. I hope that he can make it, but time's ticking, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And obviously, we ran with Jack Brown on Thursday night as well. It was still a little bit raw. And the amount of rugby that he's played over the past 2 years is a concern for me, with no reserves because of COVID. Well, I say COVID. Also, the fact that three quarters of the clubs in the Super League can't be asked to run with the reserve grade, that doesn't help either. Yes. But yeah, he's hardly played any rugby in 2 years. I look at him as a 21-year-old lad. And
needs
to be playing week in, week out. Needs to be playing 20, 25 games a year, whatever level. And he hasn't. He's played about 12, you know, 15 tops. Yeah. And yeah, it's frustrating. That's over a 2 year period as well. I think it shows at times as well. I think he does some really good things, does Jack Brown. You look at him, you think, well, you know, what a player he's going to be. But then there's that error in him, that that moment of madness, and he needs to cut that out. But like I say, he's 21. That'll come, won't it? And that'll come, obviously, the more experience he gets. And, but we definitely need a couple of forwards, and it's so important for the club to get that recruitment and retention right as well, because I imagine Hodgson will say what he wants and who he wants to keep, but I imagine the club will have a say in that as well. Those obviously high up the pecking order, your James Clarks, your Adam Pearsons, they'll have a say, or they think, you know, if a player's cheap on the salary cap and they can get a really good deal, they'll think, oh yeah, we'll re-sign him or we'll get him. But it's got to be the right players, aren't we? We don't want to be carrying dead wood, or we don't want to be signing journeymen. And I know that's why the club have been very cautious this year in who they've signed. They don't just want to pick up someone who they'll regret in 6 months' time. You know, with all due respect.
Well, we did that 2 years ago.
Exactly, we did it. With all due respect, yeah, Levy and Zonzo, Danny Langtry, we've been down that road, haven't we? We want to make sure, we need to get the right player.
We did that thinking there was going to be a reserve grid.
True, yep.
You know, and there was only us and Wakefield that actually did it properly. And I remember saying to you at the time, you know, we'd have a real case of going to the RFL and saying, you know, this is wrong, because we recruited in good faith because we were told that we had to run a reserve grade, and everyone else just laughed at it and thumbed the nose at it, and we're the only ones that did it.
Yeah.
So a large portion of our cap was taken up with Nzongu, you know, Danny Langtry, you know, and people like that who were never going to be first grade regulars, never.
No, that's true. Unfortunately, that's the way it goes, isn't it? And yeah, it's imperative that we do get this recruitment right, and you can't emphasise that enough. I just hope that the club will back Hodgson and give him what he wants, and because if we do, like you say, we've ticked loads of boxes this year. We've definitely gone forward. Hodgson has definitely taken Hull forward. I mean, look at where we're sat right now. We're fifth in the league. You know, we're in touching distance of Wigan. We've got three games in hand on Wigan. You win a couple of them, you'll go above them on the old win percentage, points percentage, whatever. Warrington, again, you're only, you know, one win again from levelling them in third. So it is, you know, we're not far off at all. You look at where Hull are this year, we're sort of comfortably sat in fifth as well. I don't think either Rovers or Leeds will go above Hull, but then, like I say, that Hull must beat Leeds on Thursday night, that goes without saying, because actually that's a huge game now in what will be Hull's first unrestricted home game in, 16, 17 months. So yeah, bring that on. But yeah, I think we're not in a bad position at all. We know the score. We've just got to kick on now and just keep on improving, and not let all this good work go by the wayside. I don't want to see Hull, you know, pick up 2, 3, 4 defeats now, because it is a tough run after Leeds. St Helens, I mean, if that game goes ahead, who bloody knows right now, because it's a farce. But you've got Catalans after that, Warrington after that, then it's the Derby. So it is a tough run coming up. And yeah, I just don't want to see all the good work be undone. We've got to try to kick on now, haven't we?
Yeah, we do. And you know, like we said the last couple of weeks, you know, the role of results that we were expecting just hasn't materialised, because we haven't played the games. You know, we looked at Lee, Huddersfield, Rovers, Huddersfield, you know, those games, and went, right, they're the ones that we're going to win and win well and get us up to third or fourth, you know, second, third, you know, to really have a crack at this. But you know, we haven't played Rovers and we've lost to Huddersfield. We beat Lee and beat Huddersfield the first time. But you know, we expected to be in a much better position at this point than we actually are. But hopefully, you know, if we can jag a result against Leeds, and then who knows what will happen after that. You know, like you said, I honestly don't think that we're going to play much more this year. I really don't. I think especially with England coming out of lockdown and people roaming free, you know, and masks not being mandated and all the rest of it, I just think that you're going to get more and more players testing positive, more and more games called off. I think it's an absolute farce. I really do.
Well, it is a farce. Hopefully, it goes, unfortunately, descended into a farce once again, just like it did last year, 2020. And what's so frustrating from an old point of view now is, like you say, this run was supposed to be where we could prop ourselves up the Super League table, and then you get the Rovers game called off from their doing, then the Salford game again from their doing, and then our doing, Lee at home, and then obviously the rearranged Rovers game gets called off for a second time. So it's really frustrating. It's so typical in many respects, because you can guarantee that wouldn't have happened if it was a tough run. Would be, you know, like I say, right now with Leeds, St Helens, Warrington, Catalans, Rovers again, you're sort of thinking, oh yeah, it will be asked to go bang, 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 bang there, won't we? I know I've just said St Helens is probably in doubt for Monday after the Leeds game, but it's just really frustrating. So like you say, this was the time where we could really string a few wins together and start pushing Wigan and Wire and, you know, get up to third and get a, you know, you prop yourself up the table and get a really good playoff position, and then who knows what can happen from there. I mean, we're still in the playoffs as it stands right now. We'd be going to Wigan, 4th versus 5th, so it's not all obviously doom and gloom or anything like that. It's just frustrating because this is the run, and it's, you know, anyone who's watched over all of the years will say, yeah, that's absolutely typical, and they probably saw it coming as well. And unfortunately, yeah, Super League is descending into a farce. It's a soap opera right now. We've already had 2 games called off this week, and it's Monday morning. It's not even dinner time yet. It's ridiculous. It's just frustrating. And like you say, with the testing thing, I don't know where we go from that. I remember asking you the question the other week and you said there's no answer. And I think that's the nail on the head, unfortunately. There is no answer to it. What do we do? I mean, do we stop testing? But then that's dangerous. Do we stop doing this or that? I mean, I know a couple of coaches and a few players have come out and said, oh, the players, be smart, you know, just look after yourselves and don't put yourselves in vulnerable situations. But then I'm thinking, you can literally pick it up going to a supermarket to get your food. You know, you can pick it up anywhere. That's the problem. And our players are out in the community. They're not multimillionaires with a butler sat at home and, you know, with the chef at home cooking the meals for them. These blokes have got to go out and live. And it's the same with the missuses who are at work and the kids who are at school. Yeah. So they've just broke off now, luckily. But, you know, it's not just as easy as it is with Premier League football, where they're on 100 grand a week and they can bubble up and do this. It's like the NRL, like you've seen in Queensland right now. I mean, I think I read it was 13 million Australian dollars to get that all set up in Queensland, which is absolutely ridiculous, and we haven't got the financial resource to do that.
Yeah, it's cost them a bloody fortune. Yeah, just to keep it running, you know, just to keep the sport going. Which, you know, and I'm sure we'll get onto it. Which is why they've took one look at it and went, well, we're not going to the bloody World Cup.
And I sort of get it in a way, but I do and I don't. But
there hasn't been a single rugby league player over here tested positive, mate.
Yeah, not one.
So no one wants to be the first one, and no one wants to go across to England, where, you know, over here we have an outbreak of, you know, 1,000 people in Sydney, and the entire state is locked down. Mm. The entire state is locked down. You know, everyone has to wear a mask. If you're found outside without a mask, you get arrested. You know, everything is locked down tight. And then you're saying to players, we want you to go across to England and play in a World Cup against players that might be positive because they're not testing as often as we're testing over here, into a hotel where no one will be wearing a mask and where COVID is running rampant. It's completely alien to these people over here to go and live the English way, you know, because England have just gone herd immunity. Screw it. You know, what did Boris say? I'd rather have bodies pile up in the streets than have another lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, it's completely alien to people over here to do that. So it's not going to happen. Do you know, the Australia, New Zealand and Tonga and Samoa and Fiji and all of them are just going to go, well, why would we go there? It's plague central. You know, we don't want it. We've seen what happens to the players that get it.
No, I get it. And obviously that comes to the Rugby League World Cup now, and obviously the news that
that
came out last week with Australia and New Zealand saying they're not coming. Right, when you look at it and you think, okay, you've said all that, COVID is obviously rife in the UK again, cases are obviously going up, blah, 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 blah. And the players look at it from an Australian point of view and thinking, right, I'm in quarantine in Queensland right now. That's going to be the case right up to the, you know, the NRL finals and the grand final, probably, if we're being honest. And well, it's not official yet, but I think that's the way it's going to pan out. They're then thinking, right, I've been in a bubble, I've not been allowed to do this and that. Do I want to go to the UK for what they probably view as Plague Island for another 6 weeks for a World Cup tournament? I'm sort of thinking, like, okay, I do sympathise with the players there. I know Damien Cook's come out in your Aussie media, James Tedesco as well, Jack Whiting as well, saying, actually, boys, I wanted to come over here, but unfortunately, they don't speak for everyone, do they? And you sort of think, okay, yeah, I can sympathise that. But then, on the other hand, Australia are advocates of the international game, and Australia only care about Australia. The NRL only cares about the NRL. Sydney Roosters only care about Sydney Roosters. That's the issue. So if you're sorry to say, no, yeah, good Agreed. Intentions, COVID, Agreed. But you don't really care about the international game. And it's not just about COVID, is it?
You know what? I think you're right in a sense. I think it is about COVID, because if COVID didn't exist, there wouldn't be an issue. They'd be across there, and players would be going across there, and there'd be no problem. But I think what COVID's done is it's brought into really, really sharp focus the fact that the Australians see the NRL and state of origin as the pinnacle of the game, because that's what they've been fed by the media over here for years and years and years. They see that as the pinnacle of the game. They don't see a kangaroo jersey as the pinnacle anymore. And a lot of that has stemmed... It's been that way since England went to summer football, since England went to summer rugby league. Because, you know, you used to have end-of-season tours where the Kangaroos would go across and play, you know, 10 club sides, 3 tests, and then go play a couple of club sides and a couple of tests in France as well. You know, those Kangaroo tours were the pinnacle of a player's career, you know, to go on a tour that lasted 3 months during the close season and go across to the UK and play in an English winter and you know, and play against the best that Great Britain had to offer. And, you know, you only look at that 1990 squad that came across and lost at Wembley and then won the next two test matches, and they're still talking about that. They're still talking about the 82 Invincibles, you know, which wouldn't have been invincible if John Holdsworth had got off his fat ass and actually given a try when it wasn't a try against when they played us. But, you know, an 86 when they won every game as well. They all talk about that. But since the Super League thing happened, it's not been the same. Now it's an end-of-season thing. It's a, you know, three games end of season. The Australia don't play club sides anymore, which was always fantastic to go and watch Hull play an Australian team, or go and watch Leeds play Australia, or go watch Wigan play Australia, whatever. I mean, Wigan against Australia, arguably Wigan had a stronger side than Great Britain some years, you know, because of their imports and stuff, and players that were eligible to play for Great Britain. Watching Wigan play Australia was always a fantastic match. Same with Widnes when Widnes were in the pop. Leeds even. Bradford, you know, just fantastic games. Doesn't happen anymore. And because it doesn't happen, and because there's no kangaroo tours, the Australian media over here have just gone, well, the pinnacle is Origin. The pinnacle is grand final wins. It's nice if you get, you know, you get chosen for a green and gold jersey. That's lovely and everything. And yet, well, you know, Channel 9 don't even show the internationals. The internationals are on Channel 7 with a second-rate commentary team. You know, it's just they don't buy into it like they used to anymore. And I think the whole COVID thing has been a very convenient excuse and everything, but it brings it into really sharp focus that the pinnacle of the game over here isn't international football,
which is sad because it should be. And I'd also argue there if they're viewing State of Origin as the pinnacle, not the Australian Kangaroos, then if. Tonga beat Australia last time they played them.
Yep.
Don't that speak volumes? You're thinking, oh yeah, you're on God's eye horse right now, saying, oh yeah, we're the best. State of Origin is a bee's knees. We're the best that rugby league has to offer. Why are Tonga going and turning you over then?
Do you know what though? Every time I've spoken about that to an Australian, they've gone, did they? Really? It's like they just forget. It's because they're not that interested in it.
Oh, that's convenient. You know, I remember speaking to a couple of Aussie mates that we had when I did my year at uni, and conveniently forgot when England beat them in the rugby union totally. At the time, conveniently forgot when England won an Ashes test at the time. It's like, yeah, that...
Absolutely. But mate, when me and you talk, we know about it because we thought it was fantastic and watching Tonga win and, you know, seeing the rise of Tonga and the rise of Samoa and the rise of Fiji even and the rise of PNG a little bit when PNG beat us, you know?
Mm.
We remember that kind of stuff because we're rugby league nerds. You're a rugby league nerd over here. You're absolutely focused on your club. You're absolutely focused on State of Origin. The Australian thing, okay. Do you know, it's just, I don't know what it is.
We've got a few of them over here. That Sid on Twitter is an absolute massive one. He couldn't give a rat's ass about England in any sport. England football, England rugby, England cricket. Mm. Best thing about cricket for me is watching England. I watched the England-Pakistan 2020 match last week. Phenomenal. One of the best sporting things I watched this year. It was absolutely brilliant. It was edgy as seat. It was tense. Honestly, it was sensational. It was TV viewing at its best. It was brilliant. And the crowd were going nuts. And you know, Sweet Caroline was on the tannoy. And you know, everything else. It was just brilliant sporting occasion. Look at rugby league right now. What's probably the... Hull FC aside, of course. The games that I've enjoyed viewing the most are when Tonga beat Australia. You go back to the World Cup when Tonga beat New Zealand. When that England-Tonga game. They are incredible rugby league moments, aren't they? You think... Jake Connor inspiring England to a test series win against New Zealand. Jake Connor inspiring England to smash New Zealand in Denver. That's the moments we know we remember. And they are huge moments, obviously. And the international game should be massive. It always winds me up because I look at rugby union and, you know, inverted commas, they turned professional in 1995. How did they make their game massive? Right, we'll play internationals. We'll obviously get our own nations playing. We'll get our Australia and New Zealand, we've got our South Africa. Now they've got Georgia, they've got Japan, they've got bloody Argentina, for God's sake. I mean, who thought Argentina would be one of the best rugby union sides in the world in 1995? It's crazy. And they've done that from playing regular internationals. I'm looking at rugby league thinking, there's your bloody blueprint. You know, you see how good it is when we do it right. I mean, the 2017 World Cup was great. The test series over here in 2018 was great. We were supposed to have the Ashes last year. Obviously, COVID put an end to that. World Cup this year is now severely in doubt now because of COVID again. But even with COVID aside, we don't take it seriously.
No, we don't. We don't, you're right. And, you know, a lot of it is just, it's mismanagement. It's just absolute mismanagement. And the NRL is a law unto itself. You know, I mean, the fact that we've got different set of rules for competitions, that's disgusting. The international rules and all the rest of it, and the NRL going, well, we'll have two referees and we'll have video refs at every game and everything. Well, we can't do that in England because not every game's on TV. Oh, tough. Sorry. That's the way we do it. Okay. Well, we're going to do six again, so we're going to do this, and this because Channel 9 want it and because that's going to save the game, it's going to speed the game up and it's going to make it more interesting for people watching it. Screw whatever everyone else in the world thinks. Oh, really? Well, you know, the English game go, well, we can maybe do six agains and you know, well, we're not going to do scrums at the moment because of COVID. Australian game, well, we're going to do scrums. We haven't got COVID. Screw you. Oh, okay, then, you know. And then this game's going to be played under international rules. Well, surely there should be a set. The whole point of rugby league is that it's simple. You know, that great Laurie Daly quote. You know, rugby league is a simple game played by simple men. Rugby union is a complex game played by wankers. You know, and it's true. It's bloody true. It's a simple game and it's got to remain a simple game. And it's becoming complex because we're tinkering and because we've got one set of rules over here and one set of rules over there. And then your international game suffers because, well, you know, a lot of the guys, well, you know, I'm used to the way we play over here now. What you want me to go back to? You want me to go back to laying on in the tackle and wrestling and everything because the international rules are different now? You know, I don't know. An international game that would be played now, I'm not sure that the six again has been mandated, has it?
Do you know, I don't even know.
It's in the Super League, and I think it's in, but I don't think it's in the international rules.
That's the thing, isn't it? When's the last time we all watched an international game of rugby league?
Well, exactly. It's been that long since there's been one. You know?
It's crazy. It's nuts. And this whole thing with Australia saying, oh, we don't really care about it and we don't really care about the test jersey and we have origin. I just say bollocks to them. You know, and then people say you can't play a World Cup without Australia. Yeah, you can, because I bet you people, that your rugby league nerds like James Tedesco, he'll go play for Italy again. You know, a couple of them will go, Josh Mansour, etc., will go play for Lebanon. Tyson Frizzell playing for Wales again.
I'd love to agree with you, but I don't think they would.
I reckon some would. Not all of them would.
Because they'd have the hard word put on there. They'd have the, you will not play Origin if you go and play for Italy.
Oh, like now Menenga right now threatening Jerome Luai because he wants to play for Samoa.
Yeah.
It's like, mate, that's the biggest...
That's what it'll be.
That is like hypocrite at its finest, though.
Yeah.
A Queenslander coming out and
but
saying
that's what
that.
That's what they'll be given, mate. That's the ultimate they'll be given, I guarantee it.
I honestly think,
mate, we need to postpone it until next year. Simple as. And you know what? I mean, it was a little bit of brinkmanship that they came out 2 weeks ago and said, it's still on. You know, I got an email from them saying, it's on. And I'm like, fuck, really? Have you told Australia and New Zealand? Because I'm pretty sure they don't think it is. And then, you know, immediately Australia came out and went, well, we're not sending a team.
Yeah.
And New Zealand went, well, we're not. You know, and then, you know, Samoa, who you know, have got a relatively unvaccinated population and haven't, you know, they're a very ethnically pure, you know, I don't want to sound like Hitler here, but they've got a very ethnically pure population of a lot of those Pacific islands, which means that they haven't had a massive amount of, especially people that live there, haven't had a massive amount exposure, I suppose, for want of a better word, to a lot of bugs and stuff like that. Now, if you introduce COVID into a community like that in any great, you know, amount, it's going to completely overwhelm their healthcare system. There's going to be people dying in the streets. Those island nations are going to go, well, if Australia and New Zealand aren't going, we ain't going. So then all of a sudden, what have you got? You've got a World Cup that's with England, Scotland, Wales, France, Ireland, Jamaica, Italy. Who else?
You're struggling because, like, even your Lebanons are obviously all Australia based.
All Aussies.
You could argue all half Aussies. Of Italy is as well.
Most of the Italy team is.
Yeah.
You know, all of the PNG team. You know, and it's PNG's been absolutely crippled with COVID. Australia have had to give them as many vaccines as they can because we don't want a nation that's absolutely crippled with it right on our doorstep that we have a very, you know, close relationship with and provide aid to and have done since the Second World War, really. Because let's not forget, it was Papua New Guinea that stopped the Japanese advancing towards the north coast of Australia. You know, that they all call them the fuzzy wuzzy angels and everything, and people still do the Kokoda track in Papua New Guinea as a tribute to the Aussies that lost the life and the Papua New Guineans that protected us the northern end of Australia from the Japanese. So, you know, we provide aid to PNG. So therefore, you know, there's players playing in the NRL and also there's the PNG team that play in the Queensland comp and everything. I cannot see anybody from the Southern Hemisphere, anybody going to England for a World Cup. Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, PNG, Australia, New Zealand are not going to attend an international tournament right now. Now, maybe turn it away and go 2021, maybe 2022, and say we'll do it then and draw a line in the sand, possibly. But they're just not going to do it. They won't. And then that therefore means that there's no Lebanon because they're all Aussie-based. There's going to be no Italy because they're all Aussie-based. You know, it also means that I very much doubt whether, you know, Hodgson, Whitehead, you know, and the English players that are based in the NRL, whether they'll even want to come over, because it means that when they do come back over here where they earn their living, they're going to have to, you know, go into a 21-day lockdown, a 21-day forced hotel quarantine, and their club won't want them to go.
True, but then you know, if you're Elliot Whitehead and you haven't seen your mum in a year...
Yeah, no, but I mean, you don't get much more proud Englishman than Elliot Whitehead and than Josh Hodgson. But if your club that pay your wages are saying to you, we don't want you to go, what do you do? What can you do?
Say, bollocks, I want to go see my mum. I want to go see my nan.
Well, yeah, fine.
No, my dad.
Fine, no worries, find another club. Find another club.
That's what they do. Yeah, yeah. I agree with you. Don't disagree at all. And that's the sad state of affairs that we're in right now. And yeah, the Rugby League World Cup. It's just so typically Rugby League. That's what's so frustrating about it. That's the word. It's just frustrating. You look at the Wallabies, they're going to be here at the same time as the Rugby League World Cup playing Rugby Union against England.
I know.
South Africa will be here as well.
I know. And that surprises me. But, I mean, I don't know because I'm English and I live here, I can see both sides of it. I see the frustration, the English frustration, the British frustration of just like, well, other people are doing it. Well, you know, we've got cricket sides over here. We've got other rugby union sides over here. We've had soccer sides over here, and they've all survived, and they haven't gone home riddled with COVID and all the rest of it. And what the hell? What the hell? What the hell? But then I also see it from the side over here of you know, we've kept it out, and we're really struggling to get the population vaccinated because we are such a, you know, geographically spread out. You know, this is 15 times the size of England or whatever, with only 22 million people in whatever. You know, they're struggling to get vaccines out to the rural sides of things. And, you know, I see both sides of it and I see the frustration, but I also get the point over here that nobody wants to be the organisation that causes a massive outbreak. Nobody wants that. You know, then I also say that we've sent people out to the Olympics, and there's people getting positive tests at the Olympics and stuff, and then they're all going to have to come back, and they're all going to have to hotel quarantine, and there's going to be leaks from hotel quarantine. It's just going to be an absolute nightmare, and I just think that the NRL, the Australian Rugby League, the New Zealand Rugby League have looked at it and went, we don't want any part of this. We don't want to be the organisation that people can point a finger at and go, it was them that brought it here. You know.
I sort of get that. I do get that. and he sort of does sympathise a little bit, but with Australia's history, like you said before, it is a very convenient excuse. And
absolutely.
I look at it from a tournament organiser's point of view, and, you know, I don't even want to praise the UK government because I can't stand the current UK government, but they have backed this Rugby League World Cup, and we're talking millions and millions and millions of pounds here. They've backed it. You know, they've put something along the lines of 20 million into it, so it's a significant, you know, fee. And it would be all COVID bubble secures. It'd be proper professional bubbles where you're literally not allowed out your hotel. Sort of looking, thinking, yeah, happy Coruscant, that includes you, mate. You know, if you if it does go ahead, you know, however unlikely.
He didn't leave the hotel. He just tried to smuggle a chick in there.
Yeah. It's just as bad. Christ.
Did you see he had to come out and he did a joint statement with his wife saying, I'm very sorry. Yeah, mate, you're screwed.
If I was his wife, I'd tell him to bugger off, but that's just
me. Well, exactly right.
Yeah, but, so that's the problem, though. Some of these blokes think they're untouchable, don't they? But, yeah. That's the thing. I mean, it was all going to be COVID bubble secure. It was all going to be professional. It's not like they'd be out, you know, in the community every night doing things, and they'd be out in the open mixing with the public. It's not going to be like that. It would be secure and it would be COVID tight, just like the cricket was last year. And that's what winds me up. The Australian cricket team came over here. They play white ball cricket against their England's one day side and England's 2020 side. Nothing happened. It was fine. It went ahead as scheduled. Australia went home, obviously, and then they had the test series against India on Australian soil, didn't you? That was fine. They say the team came back, they cracked on with their test calendar as normal. So it's not like it is a plague island when you're going to come over, you're going to catch it and you're going to go back and you're going to infect Australia. It's not like that. I do get the worry because it's, like you say, it's the unknown for obviously people in Australia. But it's just a convenient excuse for me. It really is. I look at it and I think, look at the money that the UK have put into it. It's not going to be a soap opera. It's not going to be a farce like previous World Cups gone by. It's going to be really good. It's supposed to be the biggest World Cup ever, isn't it? And obviously coinciding with the Women's World Cup as well and the Wheelchair World Cup, it's supposed to be this massive tournament, you know, history, groundbreaking moment for the game. And it's just, again, it's just so typical rugby league that it's probably in all likely going to go by the wayside. It's going to be postponed. And if that's the way we're going to do it right and do it properly and ensure that it is the biggest World Cup, then I must admit I have to agree with you. We'll postpone it to 2022, just like the football did with the Euros this year. Get it right.
Yeah.
You know, do it. Right, if that's it's frustrating. Don't get me wrong, but if that's the way we're going to make sure that this tournament is done right, then just do it next year. Because if COVID's still around next year, then Christ, God help us.
Why do it half-assed for the sake of wanting to do it now? Postpone it. Do it properly. Yeah, that's all I can think. Just get it done, but don't get it done right now.
Yeah, I have to agree, because sadly, as you say, it's like the thing that you put it on Twitter midweek as well. It's not just going to be Australia, it's not just going to be New Zealand, it will be Tonga, it's inevitable, it will be Samoa, it will be Fiji, Cook Islands, Papua New Guinea, and then it will be Lebanon, and then it will be Italy. So, and you can't have a World Cup with home nations France and Jamaica, can you? So, yeah, I get it, and unfortunately, it's going to have to be a tough decision, but it's going to be one they're probably going to have to make, and it'll probably come. And it's all right that Simon Johnson at the RFL coming out and firing shots at Australia and saying it's still going to go ahead. Is it, though?
Oh, and that's massively counterproductive, mate. I'm sorry, that's hugely counterproductive, him coming out and saying he's angry. You know, and I heard the dulcet tones of bloody Gary Schofield on the radio over here the other day, and I'm like, bloody hell, I thought I'd finish with him for good. But, you know, he was on the radio bloody telling everyone that Aussies were a bunch of whingers and all the rest of it.
He should be banned from future tournaments.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just, oh, Jesus Christ, really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I just, yeah, it's that's that kind of stuff is really counterproductive.
Yeah, it's, yeah, double-edged sword, but isn't it? You're not going to win them over saying shit like that. And that's unfortunate as it is, but yeah, I think we're going to have to draw a line over it and try to come back next year, aren't we? Because I don't know how you can play it in current climate. As you say, if Australia and New Zealand stick to the word and others follow, then there's no World Cup. It's as simple as that, and it's frustrating. It really is. It's just the amount of things we've had to whinge about at Rugby League right now, it certainly fuels the fire for us, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. Well, at least we've got something to talk about.
Well, true. But then on the other hand, I must admit, I'll give us a brief mention, because I've been whinging about the NRL recently, about the massacre scores that we've seen in the six agains and the ridiculous interpretations on head-eye contacts. We were talking during the game at half-time as well, that Parramatta-Canberra game on Thursday morning, well, Thursday night for you, that was great, really enjoyed that. Also enjoyed Brisbane giving it to Penrith again. You know, it's all right saying, oh yeah, Penrith were at the best, obviously, no Nathan Cleary, blah, blah, blah. You know, fair play to Brisbane, because they could have rolled over at 18-0 down, but they didn't, and they came back and they had a fight. North Queensland as well against Melbourne. Again, I watched that. They had a fight. I mean, I was expecting another 50-0 bloody massacre, but they didn't. You know, they came back and they gave it a good go, and that's what we want to see.
Yeah, and I thought they were unlucky not to win that, actually, North Queensland. You know, and to say that the Eels have been great all year, or the Eels have won games where they probably shouldn't have. And arguably, they're higher up in the league than they probably should be. But to see the Raiders finally click into some sort of gear and really grind out a result against a pretty good Parramatta side was really good to see. It started the round off lovely. You know, the Roosters Knights was you know, as to be expected, the Knights were a terrible team at the moment. But, yeah, I mean, I honestly thought that the Cowboys were going to beat the Storm. I really did. It just got to that stage where you looked at it and went, you know, they were coming on with a really wet sail with the Cowboys. You know, scoring in the last 5 minutes, and you just thought, oh, here we go, here we go. But they just couldn't get the next, you know, the next thing off. It's a real shame, but it was a very, very good game. Very good game. The rest of the round was pretty shithouse, to be honest, apart from the Panthers and the Broncos, which again was a good game. And the Eagles smashed the Tigers. We're gone for the year.
What did you make of Manly?
Oh, I thought they were good. I thought, again, you know, putting Trbojevic in that team is a complete... They're a completely different team. I thought Dylan Walker played well as well. You know, I thought we were dumb. I thought we played to their strengths. The one time I've seen Manly with Trbojevic struggle was when I think the Warriors turned him over last year, and what they did was they made sure he never got the ball. they kicked the ball out rather than kick to him. You know, they just stopped his kick returns dead. They muscled up around the ruck to make sure that if he was sniffing out the back, he got smashed as soon as he got the ball. It's the only time I've ever seen him completely ineffective. And the Warriors seem to have the blueprint for doing it. And it's amazed me. No other side has done it that way since. Nobody. I just thought we played to their strengths. I thought it was a pretty poor effort from the Tigers. And I thought Manly are building. You know, they seem to be building to something like the Raiders are, arguably. I think the Raiders are still sitting outside the eight. They're sitting ninth level on points with a couple of teams above them. But I honestly think the Raiders will probably finish sixth or seventh. I think they've got a fairly easy run in the last six games of the season. And I think Manly will finish pretty high up as well. I think Manly will struggle to get towards semis or grand final, but I think they're going to give a few teams a bit of a scare. I really do. They're very good. They're big up front, and they've got some really crafty halfbacks, you know, and Trbojevic at fullback, and yeah, it's great to see Kieran Foran playing well again, because you know he's a really good player, and he was being very unlucky. Probably shouldn't have left Manly in the first place, because that's his spiritual home. It's where he plays. He's always played his best football.
Yeah, they're definitely good enough to start hating him again. I think that goes without saying.
Oh, God, yeah. I never stopped.
They are the Leeds or the Wigan of the NRL, aren't they? A good old Manly.
That's it, you know. I say to people, I support two teams in the NRL. I support the Tigers and whoever's playing Manly.
Fantastic. Just on the Super League front as well, it was interesting to see Rovers go down to the south of France as well and you know, get a good lead down there. But again, Catalans have done that 3 weeks running now where they've been down at half time, they've come back fighting the second half and they've clawed it out. I mean, they look really good right now, Catalans. And again, I won't finish this podcast without mentioning French Rugby League. It's like Toulouse are still top of the championship, Catalans are still top of Super League. Something in it, isn't they? And also, it's funny to see Rovers say, oh, yeah, we're going to cap our attendances at Craven Park for the homecoming against Catalans again, ironically, at 8,000. It's like you want to get more than 8,000 when you play us anyway, you donuts. It's like,
Because of the thousands of French people that come up to that
match.
You know,
yeah, that's
huge.
We've got your safety in mind. We're going to cap it at £8,000. Okay. Right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, whatever you say, boys. Yeah, good one, Matt.
Yeah. That huge latent French population in East Hull. all those blokes in stripy shirts with onions around the necks cycling down Holderness Road. Yeah, sure, guys. Yeah, no worries.
Well, they've put the cycle lanes in now, so just need the French.
Yeah, well, possibly, yeah. To be French in East Hull, all you've got to do is admit that you've watched more than one episode of Allo Allo. That's all.
Brilliant. So. Finish off then, we've got our Hull FC / Australian club connection, and Pommy Rich has decided to go for our defunct sides this week, the rest of them.
Yeah, well, I thought, because we did a few of them, you know, the Balmain Tigers and the Western Suburbs Magpies, and we did, you know, bits and pieces of Illawarra Steelers and stuff. Well, I thought before I went on to the big ones, onto Souths and the Bulldogs and the Roosters and the teams that have been around forever, I thought I'd do just a roundup of the defunct teams or the Super League era clubs that we might have had common players with. So I've done it alphabetically. I started with the Adelaide Rams, and the first player off the rank is Dion Baird, who we had as a player for 3 years, 2000 to 2002. Everyone can remember Dion Baird because he wore a headgear. He was one of the first players you ever saw wearing headgear regularly, played in the centres for us. Very, very good defensive centre. Didn't score a lot, but he was always as hard as nails and hard to get past. I liked Dion Baird as a player. Played for Paris as well, played for Paris Saint-Germain and for the Adelaide Rams. The other two were both players that we got as a result of the Gateshead merger, Matt Daylight and Andrew Hick, who we've spoken about Matt Daylight, I think, couple of weeks ago, I think he was an ex-St. George player, but Matt Daylight and Andrew Hick both came through the Adelaide Rams. Then I went on to the Gold Coast Chargers. Now the Gold Coast Chargers were 88 to about 98, I think, 10 years. They were the precursor to the Gold Coast Titans, but we did have a few players played for both teams. David Bilden, who played for Hull 98-99, was a centre or a winger. Craig Coleman had a season with the Gold Coast Chargers. He finished his career there, as did Wally Lewis, actually. Not an Hull player, but Wally Lewis finished his career at the Gold Coast Chargers. Graham Mackay, another one of Graham Mackay's clubs, was the Gold Coast Chargers. And also Gary DeVolte had a close season with the Gold Coast Chargers when he was a Leeds player, but obviously he'd been a Hull player before that, and then finished his career at Hull in the second division as well. So Gary DeVolte played for the Gold Coast Chargers. Hunter Mariners, who were the rival team to Newcastle. When Newcastle stayed with the ARL in 97, they needed a Super League team around that area in the Hunter Valley. So they came up with the Hunter Mariners. And only one player played for the Hunter Mariners and played for Hull, and that was Richard Swain, as far as I can see. I did have a bit of a dig because I thought Marcus Bye might have played for them, but I don't think he did. Or he might have been on their books, but I don't think he actually played for them properly. So, just Richard Swain, who, you know, I mean, obviously we talk about Richard Swain in kind of hushed tones because he was... he was an absolute superstar for us and arguably should have been the Lance Todd Trophy Man of the Match in 2005, but they gave it to Kevin Sinfield because he had a little bit of blood on his head.
Not sure that's even arguable. I think that was an absolute... That's probably bordering on a criminal offence that he didn't get the Lance Todd Trophy that afternoon.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, he was fantastic, and then charged down the equaling drop goal. You know, and just, you know, yet again, another example of why the Lance Todd Trophy shouldn't be decided until final whistle.
Yeah.
Do you know, because Danny Houghton would have won it as well. There's two Hull hookers that have been absolutely screwed over by that, by the picking the Lance Todd Trophy before the end of the game. But there you go. So he's the only Hull player that played for Hunter Mariners. Northern Eagles, who were the short-lived team that were formed when Manly merged with North Sydney Bears during the Super League War. Only Marco Mealy, who made his debut for the Northern Eagles, for one season, and then and of course ended his career at Hull. And Peter Sharp, who was our coach, was the only coach that Northern Eagles ever had. He coached them for the three seasons that they were in existence before they ended up back as Manly on their own, and North Sydney Bears ceased to exist and still kind of. You know, still have a bit of money behind them and still try and put their hand up every time anything happens with any NRL club to say, we'll take over, but they've never quite got there. The South Queensland Crushers, who were the Gold Coast team during the Super League War. Now, again, we had three or four players play for them and Hull. Michael Eager, who was unlucky with Hull, actually. A couple of seasons that were, I think, 04 and 05, but really blighted by injury. I think he only made six appearances in each season. More well-known, probably, over in England as a cast player, but did have a couple of seasons for us. Another team that Graham Mackay played for with the South Queensland Crushers.
Wow.
Literally, honestly, he just went from club to club, didn't he? Bless him. And then Craig... It's just ridiculous. Craig Wilson, who played for Hull in that 2000 season. He was one of the ex-Gateshead players as well. Now, Craig Wilson went on to become an assistant coach at St George. And the last game he ever played for was when we beat Bradford, 25-12 at the Boulevard. And he did actually officially retired because his knees were knackered and everything. And we had a bit of an injury crisis. So much so, in fact, that our halfback that day was Scott Rhodes. Who only made probably two or three appearances for Hull, I think, but he played that game. And we had a real, again, talking about ragtag team, we had a real ragtag team that day. And Craig Wilson came out of retirement, didn't even tell his wife he was playing because he was petrified. She'd lock him in the house and wouldn't let him out to play because his knees were absolutely buggered. And he just went to the game ostensibly to be a coach. And then the next thing she sees is him running out onto the pitch with a whole shirt on and playing the last game of his career. Craig Wilson, bless him. And Philly Saru as well was a South Queensland Crusher player. Now, we've talked about Philly before, but yeah, he was a South Queensland Crushers. Now, I did have a look at the Perth Western Reds. Three players for the Perth Western Reds that played for Hull. Matt Daylight, again. Jeff Doyle, who had a season or two with Hull. And James Grant as well, who we spoke about in a Balmain context a couple of weeks back. And then the Newtown Jets, who ceased to be in about, I want to say 88, I think they finished up. We only had one player that's played for Newtown Jets and Hull, and that was Bruce Ryan, who played for Hull in the 50s. He was an ex-Olympic sprinter, was Bruce Ryan. Probably better known in England as being a Leeds player, but played for Hull 84 matches and scored 60 tries between 1947 and 1950. That's not a bad return, is it? My dad reckoned that he was the fastest thing in the world. My granddad had always said to him he was the quickest he'd ever seen at the Boulevard. But he was a little bit, it's a nice way to put this, from all accounts, he was a little bit windy. He was a little bit, very much a sprinter, had that kind of nervous edge and the nervous tick of a sprinter, and didn't particularly like to get his head in where the boots were flying or anything. Who does? But he was very much a finisher, but not a grafter. And I think Hull, in the end, saw him as a little bit of a luxury, and he ended up going to Leeds, where he had a similar return at Leeds as well, 40-odd tries in 50 matches before he came back over to Australia and finished his career at Newtown. And the other connection with Newtown is our coach, Phil Sigsworth, finished his career at Newtown Jets. He was a player for Newtown Jets as well. So there you go. That's as many defunct and Super League era clubs as I could find.
Fantastic. Good stuff. As for all this week, then, big game against Leeds, we've just got to hope we can pull a win out the bag again, hopefully get a couple of names back, Josh Reynolds being one, and give it a good go, because it's probably bordering on must-win territory, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it is. If we have a serious ambition to get into that top three or four and to actually make a bit of a dent on the playoffs, this is a game we have to win.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it would be nice to do the double over Leeds, something we managed to do in 2019 for the first time in 12 years. So to do it twice in 3 years, that would be quite nice as well.
Yeah, and it's Leeds. And it's Agar. Never mind the fact that it's Leeds. It's bloody Agar. I just want to stop him in his tracks.
Exactly. And there'd be no better way to get back to, you know, winning ways with a good win over Leeds. And as always, we'll be there cheering him on, and come on, you will.
Absolutely.